Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we call it, real debate without the hate. I'm Greg Matuszak, a liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Emily Brewer, Republican from Virginia.
I'm Rebecca Kushmider, a liberal Democrat from Maryland.
I'm Cliff Dunn, a Republican from Virginia.
I'm DJ McGuire, your conservative Democrat from Virginia.
And I'm Kevin Kelton, a moderate Democrat from sunny Los Angeles, California.
The More Perfect Union is one of the fastest-growing podcasts on iTunes, and it can also be found on iHeartRadio, YouTube, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com.
So this is our last show just before the Electoral College meets on December 19th to decide who the official president-elect will be. Guys, ladies, what are your expectations of that meeting?
I think we're not going to have any major surprises. You got to remember that over 25 of the states are bound. If anyone was watching SNL on Saturday night, you probably saw the incredible Kate McKinnon stunting as Hillary Clinton yet once again, which, by the way, she's incredible. And if anyone noticed, there was a check presentation at the caroling moment in the scene where she offered the elector $1,000. And so, DJ, I think you can probably explain this pretty well, but there are fines associated with some electors not voting as their state has gone in at least 25 states.
Yeah, there are some states that say by law you have to vote for the nominee of your party that you are pledged to support. It's not the case in all states, but it is the case in some of them. It's probably the case in enough that you won't see any major changes. I agree with Emily there. Yeah, but half the states, the electors are by law bound to vote for the person that they said they're going to vote for.
Just so you guys know, the major states that we'd be thinking there would be some major shifts in, possibly places like California, Virginia, Ohio, places like that, you know, that have major amounts of votes. Those are some of the states specifically that have laws against electors voting out of yeah. step.
I mean, the only places you've seen, I will say, eruptions of electors talking about not voting for their candidate were Washington and Colorado. And I believe Washington specifically is the one with the $1,000 fine that was being referred to in that joke.
Yes.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, you're probably going to get somewhere in the range of 10 to 12 electors. I'd put my over under at 12 who break ranks. I think that'll be about the end of it. And most of those will be Hillary electors, because I think it's 8 or 9 of the ones who have said they're going to break are, again, Colorado and Washington, which, as we all know, Hillary won both states. So no impact.
So what's the logic of those people breaking rank?
Their argument, they're calling themselves Hamilton electors. What they're trying to do is put forth an example to Republicans like, hey, look, you could vote for this person. But there's been sort of a movement from Lawrence Lessig to try and convince some electors to flip. He says he had up to 20 a week ago, Republican electors. I don't know how much veracity there is to those statements, but he was offering to cover any legal fees incurred by bound electors switching.
A few of the Hillary electors who were flipping were also Sanders people who got selected as electors at their like congressional district level earlier on in the process. And I know 3 or 4 of them were saying they weren't going to vote for Hillary even before November happened.
You know what scares me, guys, is I got to look at it this way, is that this year for some people was really difficult or hard for them to, not vote for Bernie if they're, Bernie or vote for Bernie over Hillary, or possibly they weren't a Donald Trump fan. But, if the shoe's on the other foot, this is a scary situation. What do you guys think about that? Like, what if in 4 years, the shoe's on the other foot? How does that feel to you?
This is terrifying. I mean, this is absolutely terrifying that the will of the people, and we're not talking popular vote, but once again, how the rules have been set down, can all of a sudden be switched at a moment's notice by a couple hundred electors. And it's kind of terrifying, but at the last minute, that's what these guys were there for. If for some reason, or these men and women, if they felt that the person who was elected wasn't qualified, or if something went wrong, and it was that last firewall or to stop. And that's what I think the liberal thought process is right now, is this guy's not who should be elected. And we all know it, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And whether it was the Russian hacking or whether it was all these other things, That's the basis behind it. Now, whether I think it's going to happen or not, we all have our conspiracy wishes and dreams. You know, I still think George W. Bush will be tried at The Hague some days with Cheney. It's not going to happen. It's just my dream.
I would like to see Dick Cheney tried at The Hague myself. But, you know, I think you have to be fully human for that. And he's at least 80% cyborg now.
Oh, yeah. And the other 20 is Lizard Man. So
here's my take on the Electoral College. Here's my take. If you're going to have the Electoral College, you cannot pick and choose which aspects of it you like, okay? I have been arguing since 2008, and actually probably before that, that the Electoral College should be abolished and we should have a popular vote presidency. That's my take, but that's not what we have. So, you know, the Trump people are saying now the Electoral College is gold because if it wasn't for the Electoral College, he would not be the president-elect. But you can't say we like the aspect of the Electoral College that breaks up the states into various electoral votes, but we don't like having the electors and giving them the autonomy to vote the way that we want. It's all one package, okay? This is what the Constitution allows, and faithless electors are allowed in the process. So I don't hold out hope that Trump is not going to be elected by the Electoral College. I do hope that enough electors move off of him so that he comes out under 300. To me, that's a magic number. Because what I personally hope will happen is we send a message to this man that I understand that you're an egomaniac and you're probably going to run this country as if you got a 10 million vote majority, but be on notice that you are a minority elected president.
Well, and that also sends a message to Congress, and they need to be hearing this as well. You know, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan need to hear, you know, that a majority of the popular vote and even some of their own folks in the Republican Party have deep misgivings about this administration.
There have been 700 times, at least over 700, that people have introduced legislation to try to amend or abolish the Electoral College. I just don't see it happening. I think that our forefathers had a reason because they did not want one state. They had foresight in this, I think. I really do.
Amen.
Hang on a second. Wait. I just want to take a moment here. To reveal the utter ahistorical ignorance of the people who call themselves Hamilton electors for this reason. Hamilton himself actually tried to use the Electoral College to sneak into office in 1796, someone who had never actually been nominated for president or considered a presidential candidate ever. That would be Senator Pinckney of South Carolina in what was considered an Adams-Jefferson race in 1796. His idea was that he himself, with his various parlor game politics, would deny John Adams the votes that he needed so that Pinckney would become president of the United States. But the fact of the matter is, his plan, not only was his plan thoroughly underhanded and ridiculous, it was so short-sighted that angry Federalist voters refused to vote for Pinckney and actually voted for Jefferson instead, making Jefferson the vice president, putting him in a position to win the election of 1800. Calling yourself a Hamilton elector basically says you either want Mike Pence to be president of the United States or you don't know what the hell you're doing.
I think the best thing that'll come out of this mess is actually litigating the faithless elector laws, because those have never actually gone before the Supreme Court. And so it's actually, you know, it's uncertain whether if somebody is fined $1,000, if the courts would actually uphold that. And if they do, that actually gives a bunch of states much more of a stick for next time around in the future.
And I would say two more things just briefly, and I'll try to make it brief, and I apologize. One, we have to remember that the framers came up with the Electoral College, but they did not come up with the notion of a state electorate gets to decide who all of the electors are in a winner-take-all format. That came about in the 1820s and the 1830s, and as I will say every time in various things about the 19th century, it was all Andrew Jackson's fault. The second thing I would say is one thing we might want to consider actually is giving the electors more power and not less. We might want to consider, and this would require constitutional change, we might want to consider giving the electors full four-year terms, giving them the authority not only to elect a president once, but to remove a president later on. It would be an additional check on presidential power that we do not have, that parliamentary governments do have, because the parliamentary caucus is a check on the power of the prime minister. We may want to consider doing something similar with the electoral college here.
I was going to point out, we have in Maryland, and this is a trigger law, it's not something that's actually in effect, a provision that if a certain number of states also ratify a similar law, Maryland is bound to go with the national popular vote for electors as opposed to the state popular vote. And that was introduced by a gentleman named Jamie Raskin, who was actually just elected to my district in Congress. So he's a bit of a constitutional crusader type. I think he and I are going to be best friends. He's very, very liberal. but that's another idea where there's this idea of the states binding their electors to the national popular vote as opposed to the sort of parochial state popular
vote. Even if it does happen, let's pretend, let's put on our make-believe hats. Mine has unicorns on it. Let's pretend it does happen and it goes to Congress. What's Congress going to do?
Not a damn thing.
All right, so it's
Congress exactly, is going to elect Trump.
Repeal Obamacare.
They do that every time they go to the bathroom.
Exactly, exactly. It's a rider in every piece of legislation.
Repeal Obamacare.
Right. Once again, I see Dick Cheney in chains at The Hague way before this happening. So it goes in my erotic political fan fiction.
I'm sorry,
again,
chains and the word erotic should never be used in the same sentence.
Oh,
that's a really bad imagery for me.
I've got a whole it's part of my two part volume, but I'm going off. Speaking of things that shouldn't happen, let's talk about North Carolina right now.
Yeah, North Carolina elected itself a new governor, and the old governor and the legislature decided they hate him. So they have changed a whole bunch of laws to limit the process by which he can appoint his cabinet or whatever the North Carolina equivalent of a cabinet is. And it was in a special legislative session that was called at the 11th hour so that the old governor could sign it before his term is completed. At some point they were closing the gallery, they were barring the press. It was, it was one of these unprecedented, horrible things. And the new governor is already threatening to sue on all of this. It's going to be very expensive, and it's wildly crazy. But I'm sitting here looking at it and thinking, oh, that's not unlike what some people are suggesting that Biden do in trying to appoint Merrick Garland in that 15-minute window between when the old senators leave and the new senators get sworn in.
Right. It's pretty much like just a giant jerk move that North Carolina is doing. They're mean girls is what they are. They're a bunch of mean high school girls, just petty, vindictive. And the second that they get a Republican governor, they're going to change all those laws back.
Yeah, they just put them in 4 years ago for the Republican governor, didn't they?
Yes.
Go on. North Carolina is turning into a purple state, and so they're going through that identity crisis that kind of Virginia is coming into right now. I mean, if you look at North Carolina, Charlotte, Raleigh, some of the major areas are turning more and more blue, whereas, the Appalachian Mountain areas, the hills by the coast, it's all very, very rural Republican. And so I think they're in a struggle right now for what's turning into a purple state.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think this is a very good argument for is a complete ban on lame duck sessions. They are, generally used to ram through legislation that is, basically that nobody outside the, whether it's the Beltway or the State House wants. It'll never happen, but I wish we could have a constitutional amendment saying once your election is done, the old session, you can't meet again. The doors are locked for you because you get stuff like this. You get, there's been all this talk, in various years of trying to pack through unpopular budget bills and so forth during the lame duck session when, a huge chunk of Congress doesn't have any responsibility to anybody anymore. This sort of nonsense at all levels really should stop.
We are one of the very few countries on earth that essentially allows the old legislature to continue to act after the new legislature has been elected. I remember the 1997 election in the UK where Tony Blair crushed John Major. Tony Blair was prime minister within 24 hours of that election. The old parliament was out and the new parliament was in. We have the reason we have a lame duck session is because essentially the legislative, the transition period for a lot of these states was built at a time when it took 2 to 3 months for a new legislator to get from their home district to the state capital. That just isn't the case anymore. The easy way to do this is to just have state legislators say, you know what, the hell with the transition period. The new legislature is elected on November 8th. It takes office on November 9th. And in fact, I think South Carolina actually has something where the new legislature takes less than a month before it takes office. But that's, I think, the first thing that we need to do is have the new legislator take office much, much sooner than we currently have them. You don't have lame duck sessions if the new legislature takes office immediately.
When DJ all right, so
keeping in mind, this wasn't a standard lame duck session. This was a special session called specifically to do this thing.
Yes, but the mechanics are identical when you get right down to it. I mean, yes, the governor had to go through the trouble of calling it, but if the old legislature was not still in session, then this would not be happening.
Right.
So we kind of agree on two things. Everyone, and if I'm wrong, let me see. So lame duck sessions are pretty awful, but the only thing more awful than lame duck sessions is pretty much the North Carolina Republican Party, because they're just horrible people.
I did not say that.
No.
Something other than the dish at a fundraiser.
For the record, Greg, I did not say that either, but I may be more amenable to your interpretation than Cliff is. Right.
Now, speaking of states that have crummy state laws, I'm trying to find a segue here. Ohio was in the news this past week.
Ohio's the best.
Greg, you live in Ohio and happen to be a big fan of Governor John Kasich. Why don't you tell us a little bit about why Ohio has been in the news?
So there were two bills on Kasich's desk this week. One was, and they both dealt with abortion. One was a 6-week abortion bill, which after 6 weeks, no, it was called the heartbeat bill. Yeah, it was quite restrictive. The other one was what Kasich eventually signed was a 20-week with no with nothing to do with no exceptions for incest, rape, or any. The only exception, of course, is the mother's life, which he did sign. It's still not going over well in Ohio with the liberals. And it was kind of said, well, at least I didn't sign the 6-week one. So
now let me ask something. Is this an attempt to create a test case that can go to the Supreme Court where we can test Roe versus Wade at the state court, at the Supreme Court level? Is this what's going on?
I think absolutely they're creating a test case. And I think Kasich is smart enough to sign the 20-week bill because he thinks this is the case that can win. If you look back over the history of major abortion court decisions, you've got Roe versus Wade, which was decided on 14th Amendment grounds and deals with at what point the state has a compelling interest in a pregnancy being carried to term. And the decision in 73 with that was at the point of fetal viability. There was a second case about 20 years later, Casey versus Planned Parenthood in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Where they upheld the fundamentals of Roe versus Wade. However, they started being a little grayer on what that viability point means, probably because the science was starting to change. I think the science has changed even further. I don't know that anybody could make a really good 14th Amendment case to overturn Roe, because I think that if we start getting into what is medical privacy? What are people entitled to in terms of seeking medical treatment? What is compelling state interest in pregnancies being carried to term? We get into legislating things that or judicially legislating things that are not really within the purview of the law. And the Roberts Court is not big on ruling on moral grounds. They're a pretty legalistic court. However, I do think that the science is on the side of these 20-week bans, where you can walk in and say, listen, we've got 21-weekers, 22-week preemies surviving. How can we say that 24 weeks is the absolute point of viability? So I think Kasich knows that the 20-week bans are potentially quite likely to be upheld. The other thing he knows, and the reason why there aren't any of the exceptions that you would normally see for rape, incest, health of the mother, or fetal anomaly, is because that is what triggers the lawsuit.
I want to make a point that it was not the 14th Amendment. The right to privacy derives sort of from the Fourth Amendment, but it also comes from a tangle of emanations and penumbras, to paraphrase Justice Douglas, that basically cobbled together an additional right off of the right to privacy. Now, DJ, go.
Yeah, I was going to say what Roe versus Wade did was it established a trimester regimen for where states could act and where states couldn't act. What Casey versus Planned Parenthood did was essentially throw out the trimester regimen and say, no, the point of viability is essentially the tipping point. Before the point of viability, the state is restricted in what it can do because it infringes on individual rights. And they actually used Amendments 4, 5, 9, and 14. But after the point of viability, the state has freedom to do what Kasich essentially did, which is to ban abortion in nearly every case after 20 weeks. This is Ohio's new law is going to win in the courts, because under Casey versus Planned Parenthood, they're not doing anything before the point of viability. So anything that they do after viability, the state has a compelling interest under Casey versus Planned Parenthood. This is not something that's going to overturn Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And given that Casey versus Planned Parenthood essentially replaced Roe v. Wade as our structure of abortion law, this is really something that is within the Casey framework. The other thing I would remind people is most Americans would say before the point of viability, they are not comfortable with the state telling an expectant mother what to do with that preborn child. After the point of viability, a majority of Americans are very comfortable having the state protect that preborn human being, because they believe that after the point of viability, a preborn child is a person that should have their rights, including the right to life, guaranteed. So John Kasich, in vetoing the six-week bill, which would have challenged Casey versus Planned Parenthood and probably lost, but signing the 20-week bill, which is within the Casey framework, he is acting in a constitutional manner, and I genuinely believe he is signing a law that a majority of Americans and a majority of Ohioans would largely support, because it is saying, look, after the viability point is before 20 weeks, after the viability point, the preborn child should have rights, and the state of Ohio is going to give them rights. And I think most Americans and most Ohioans would support that belief. Not all of them, mind you, but enough to create a majority political coalition in the case it could feel safe signing that bill.
So there's something that's in the language. They didn't talk about specifically incest, rape, anything of this nature, but there's something else that they put in the bill, that after 20 weeks, there's a viability test. And I've got to figure out what they mean by a viability test. However, that's some verbiage that they did put in there. So I believe that's an open opportunity for pregnancies that are basically close to miscarriage or probably not viable in the sense that we would probably all agree with.
Some sort of fetal diagnosis. And, you know, and if you actually look at the numbers, and I'm as pro-choice as they come, but if you look at the numbers, the number of abortions that actually happen past the 20-week mark is minuscule, and many of them are not elective. They have to do with either the physical health of the pregnant person or some sort of fetal anomaly that is incompatible with life, and carrying would be a hardship.
And this is a hard topic for me, and I'm sure you guys have heard me say it before, but any of our new listeners, maybe, I'm a product of adoption. Someone carried me to 9 months, and I'm fortunate to be here because someone valued life. Oh, that's wonderful. But because of that, I probably have a harder line stance on abortion than most, because it wouldn't be here otherwise. So it's a moot point with me. However, I do agree with what Governor Kasich did, because I don't think that the heartbeat bill would have stood up. I think that this was a move in the right direction for the pro-life movement, and I think it gives the majority of Americans enough wiggle room to feel confident with where it's going.
What it does not do is change the political dynamic, and as a former cost estimator, I tend to analyze everything. The simple fact of the matter is, whatever one believes about what the pro-life movement wishes to do, the simple fact of the matter is our policy solution has costs that are largely borne, or almost entirely borne, forgive the pun, by women of childbearing age. And unless we find a way to make those costs more equitable in some way, shape, or form, we're going to have a hard time winning politically. And we should have a hard time winning politically, because we should not say that something is so important that we can just ignore the fact that a certain group of Americans bear the entire cost and the rest of us don't. If that's an impediment to us succeeding, then we need to say that is something we need to fix. And we need to do things like, say, look at state child support laws and encourage states to include prenatal costs and the cost of lost wages in child support. Because as it is right now, we're essentially saying we want to save these children and we want all of you to bear the cost almost exclusively. That doesn't work in America. It shouldn't work in America. And we should take a step back and say, okay, how can we make these costs more distributed? How do we make it more equitable? Because if this is something that we all need to do, then we should all be in this together.
Well, and DJ, yes. you've hit on a deep point of law there, that there are a lot of cases where the state has a quote unquote compelling interest in doing something, but all too often the courts will grant that right and not then turn around and recognize, okay, this a compelling interest does not mean the state gets to do this for free.
Right.
Your exactly. life is an unfunded mandate.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Yes. Rebecca, that is like, very well said. That is very, very, very well said.
There's something, though, that as a Republican, I believe in – I'm pro-life. It is what it is. It's not going to change. But I will say this, is that as a Republican, I also feel like when we talk about being pro-life, we've also got to offer a solution. And that's why there's something I want to work on, should I ever be fortunate enough to be able to get the chance to work on this, is I really want to work on foster care and adoption reform. Because it's so important to be able to ease the access. If we're going to be pro-life, we've got to offer solutions to allow people to adopt children that are in those situations. Okay.
So what we're saying here, that we agree once again on about two different things. One, this is a very complex issue, and there's a lot going on, probably both legally, morally, and on all fronts. That's one thing we can all agree on. I like it when we all agree. And the second thing is that, as we all know, John Kasich is a huge asshole. So
we
all agree on that. So
you're here. Well, you know, I'm glad at the end of the show we can actually get to a point of laughing. I've got one more question I think I really want to pose to you guys. So we're coming into Christmas week. It's going to be a good time, hopefully, with our families. If not, I'll send everybody a bottle of wine from my shop. But I just kind of want to ask you guys, you know, what are you doing this week with your family as far as you watching a good movie? Greg, what are you thinking?
Oh, my first job ever, one of my first jobs that I had to lie about my age was at a video store back when, you know, we watched VHSs. So I love movies and I love Christmas movies. So, of course, without a doubt, films like Die Hard, which is a Christmas movie, as we all know, goes without saying, is without a doubt one of my favorite. But to be quite honest, we watch the – I have young daughters who still keep asking, why am I showing them Die Hard? And the seven-year-old has nightmares.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay. That's what I keep saying. And she goes, can I take my hands off my ears? And I go, it's okay. But actually, the one that I always show, my wife always shows Elf, and I like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Even though it's not supposedly Christmas, it's the one I still love the most. And, you know, and 2016 was a tough year and all, but that's the one I show.
But the other thing that somebody suggested we should talk about is, what science fiction movie depicts this year's presidential election or the administration to come?
As for sci-fi films that best describe this election, I'm going to go really, really dark. And I'm not going to go with a series. I'm not going to go with a movie at all. I'm going to go with a TV series. I fear that The Man in the High Castle will be far too much like a reality show than we are all comfortable with.
Really? That's pretty dark, man.
Yeah, but God bless the Amazon people. They come up with a great science fiction show based on a Philip K. Dick novel. The American Electra turns it into a Goram reality show.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I am loving Man in the High Castle, I just started on season two tonight. I'm going to go with Elysium from a couple of years ago. That really feels like, in some respects, where things are heading in the long run.
That's a great one, where the haves and the have-nots, or as John Edwards says, the two Americas.
Yes.
I'm kind of feeling like I don't watch a lot of sci-fi, but I'm thinking The Matrix, because you just don't know what direction things are going. So I'm going with The Matrix.
I'm in the middle of reading some of the Harry Potter series with my son right now. And we're getting into Goblet of Fire, and we just finished Goblet of Fire. We're getting into Order of the Phoenix, and everything with the misinformation about Harry Potter in the Daily Prophet, and that the rise of Voldemort, no one believing that the evil is approaching, and Dolores Umbridge, who reminds me of Kellyanne Conway, only not blonde. All of that is kind of ringing true to me.
Have you guys, what about Terry Gilliam's Brazil? We're living so much, you know, just paperwork and files on everybody. And as it turned out, because of a typo, there's a huge mistake Tuttle. That causes, Tuttle. Right, Tuttle instead of Tuttle. And as it turns out, the DNC hack was because of a typo.
Legitimate right, versus illegitimate.
And the other one, of course, would be, I'm sure Kevin's going to say this, was Idiocracy.
Oh, good God.
A movie that I still haven't seen. It's been recommended to me a dozen times, and I still haven't seen it.
Don't see it. You will lose your will to live. You will slit your own wrists by the end of the movie. It's way too close to home.
I'm going to answer this question because I'm going very, very simple. To me, this election season and the administration to come is a metaphor for the movie Alien. Okay, we should have killed the Trump monster with a fork when it broke out of the GOP's stomach last January. And I still hold hope that after he has taken over the ship for a little while, that in 2020, when Elizabeth Warren is running for president,
oh God,
that the American electorate will say, "Get away from her, bitch."
So as we draw this week to a close, let's make sure we all wish everybody a Merry Christmas. But
yes.
We want to thank everybody
and Happy Hanukkah.
I want to thank everybody for listening for us. It's been a great 2016. Make sure you like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And if you love us, please share our link on your Facebook. And if you enjoy political debates, please join us on Open Fire, our discussion group online on Facebook. We're all there. We'd love to see you there too. So until next time, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Merry Electoral College Holiday, and whatever else there may be that I forgot. Good night, guys.
Good night.
You know what I want for Christmas this year? I want a remake of Aliens with Elizabeth Taylor. That's what I want.